I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. It's Veterans Day, observed every November 11th to honor the service of our military veterans. In fact, it was established by President Woodrow Wilson back in 1919 when it was called Armistice Day. There is a military-civilian divide with just 1% of Americans in the military, many soldiers and Marines doing multiple tours in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Today on Radio Times, bridging that divide, fostering greater understanding and dispelling some myths. And we have a trio of guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. And let me introduce them to you. Michael Miller is a U.S. Marine Corps and Army veteran. He's a poet, owner of Open Mike's Internet Cafe that's in Chester, Pennsylvania. He's also a member of Warrior Writers. And Michael Miller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here.
Also with us is Jacinta Johnson, and she is a retired Air Force Staff Sergeant, works now in Human Resources at the Veterans Multi-Service Center in Philadelphia. And Jacinta, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And we also have Wynn and Rowe with us. And she's a therapist who specializes in the treatment of trauma-related diagnoses. Her dad, an Air Force colonel who served in the Vietnam War. And Wynn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Michael, let me begin with you. You served in Afghanistan during that war. When were you there?
I was there between 2011, 2012. Well, we moved up in 2010 and went over shortly thereafter.
And where were you stationed, if you were stationed somewhere?
Fort Dix.
And then when you got to Afghanistan, where were you?
It was Bagram Airfield. Yeah.
And you were there for what, about a year?
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, it's funny because in the wintertime, when we first got there, it was quiet, and then we went on missions, and it was like almost like a weird vacation in a way, to a place you never really wanted to go, but it was free, so you said, might as well. But once the summertime, snow started melting, things got really hot over there. So,
yeah. Well, you were injured. I guess it was an IED accident. What happened?
Yes. Well, I was on a mission one evening. It was actually pretty late in the evening because we normally did all of our running at night. And I was on the side of a mountaintop out there and rolled over an IED, and it blew up my truck.
And what happened to you?
Well, I had a little bit of a TBI, you know.
Traumatic brain injury.
Yes. Yeah. And right now, I suffer from PTSD, anxiety, depression, things of that nature. You know, it's kind of like a weird care package. You get all of these things together.
A weird care package.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable talking about all of this?
Yes. Yeah, I am. You know, I think it's something that people need to discuss more because I think that it opens a door. It helps to dispel myths about PTSD, about, you know, veterans in general. I had one of my daughters tell me that one of her friends told her when she was in high school, like, oh, your father's going to come back crazy. But I think it's really how things are oftentimes depicted in the media.
I do want to pick up on that. But Jacinta, let me get you in on the conversation. You signed up pretty early. You were pretty young when you joined the military.
Yes, I did delayed entry when I was 17. So March of 2006 is when I initially signed the contract. But I left in August 2006 when I was 18.
When you were 18 years old. And
yes.
Why? And this is the Air Force.
Yes, this is the Air Force.
Was it the Air Force in particular, or that was just the opportunity?
No. My cousin actually at the time was a master sergeant in the Air Force, and I was going to go to the Navy. And she was like, no, you're going to go to the Air Force. And so I did. I went up to the Air Force. So,
why did you sign up? Why did you want to be in the military?
Because I needed to get away from home. I was going down the wrong path. I was getting in a lot of trouble. I came from a kind of a broken home. So I needed to do something to get away. I knew staying in Wisconsin was not it for me.
And you saw the military as the way out, but also a place you could, get to know yourself a little
better? Get to know myself, get that free education like they promise you, travel the world, which is something I've always wanted to do and I got to do. So that is why I joined.
Let me turn to you, Wynden, and there's so much that I do want to talk about, especially with what we have just heard. You specialize in the treatment of trauma-related diagnoses, and we hear the word PTSD. It's batted around a lot. How do you define it? How should we understand that?
I think if you think about the acronym PTSD, it's post-traumatic stress disorder. And so when we think about those words post-trauma, It means after something bad has happened. And then when we look at the words stress disorder, what we're looking at is a maladaptive process that has taken place in our stress response. And so my mission in all of this is to help people understand that this is not what we think of as craziness. This is a very explainable and understandable diagnosis. It applies to communities far outside of the veteran community. And I think that, you know, if we think about it as the concept of if you break your leg, you seek treatment for that. And if we think of this as an adaptive process that has taken place in our nervous system, there is treatment for that. And so I want to get that message out as much as possible.
Is it a kind of hypervigilance? I mean, I'm sort of imagining, especially Michael, having served in a war, that you get sort of acclimated to thinking that something terrible might be happening. Is that part of it?
Yeah, so if you think about it in combat specifically, your mode of operation is being in survival mode. And that's very important to be thinking that way in order to survive. But when you come home and you reintegrate into a system and into a society where that isn't your daily process, the way that you've changed to exist in one cultural experience doesn't apply very well to how we live and exist here. And so it takes change and time to readjust to that. And so that's why we see that hypervigilance, that's why we see flashbacks and that anxiety present, because it's sort of like the old system is still operating right in the new environment.
Which makes me want to ask you, Michael, about coming home for you, what that was like for you.
Well, it's so funny because you wait for the day that you actually are able to hop on a plane and come home and kiss the kids. But you feel alien in a way, like you're in a familiar place. You're around familiar people. Everybody says they understand until, you know, you get into an argument or something. Then everything you do, you're doing it on purpose. You know what you're doing. But it's like a living prison in a way, because it's like all of these bells and whistles are going off. Like for me, when I used to hear really loud noises, you know, sometimes even softer noises, but now it's pretty much with loud, abrupt noises, your body responds. And I can turn around and see someone using a hammer, and I can identify with that and say that's where the sound came from. But you have a loss of control over all of the bells and whistles. You know, it's on, your senses are on overload.
And have you been able to, in a sense, recognize that? So when it's happening, you've been able to say, okay, that's a hammer. It's not something more threatening than that.
Well, I mean,
does that help if you can think that way?
I mean, it helps just about to recognize it. It probably helps just as much to someone who doesn't know how to swim and being thrown in 10 foot of water. You know, you don't know how to swim. It's not helping you. The knowledge is weird. You have no control. And we always try to, our brain is funny. It always tries to make sense of the world around us. You know what I mean? It's always searching to make sense, but it's your body is reacting to something that you made sense out of. You know, and it's no clear cut way to get around it. A lot of times you can adapt. People who don't know how to read, they adapt. People who go blind, they find ways of adapting. The frustration and everything is there, of course.
Right.
But we're talking about feeling like you're literally under attack by your own body. Like your body betrays you. Your eyes see what's going on, but your body betrays you, you know.
And I have to say to our listeners, both Wyndon and Jacinta are nodding their heads. You just raised your hand, Wyndon. Go ahead. I know you want to say something, and then Jacinta, I want to get you back in on the conversation here.
So we're really blessed to be in the city of Philadelphia because we have such a trauma-informed community that's building here. And one of our top researchers and spokespersons in this field is Sandra Bloom. And she says the brain is in the body. And I heard you, Michael, several times reference that you experienced this diagnosis, if you will, in your body. And I know for all of us in here right now, there's a slight level of nervousness. We're on live radio and we can feel our hearts are beating a little faster. We're breathing maybe a little differently. So the trauma response is that times 1,000. So this is not isolated to the brain. This is a physical response, and the physiology needs intervention as well. And I think that's where in the field we're so limited, because we think of this as a top-up treatment process.
Above the neck.
Yeah, but the whole body, the whole system needs to be treated, and that's where we're really missing the mark right now.
Jacinta, I see, again, I see you nodding your head. Go ahead.
Yes, so it, just kind of going off our conversation we had before where PTSD does not always come from war. My PTSD does not come from war. So mine came from an experience that I had in the military. So for me, I completely understand that fear and just feeling like you can't move and you can't stop your heart from feeling like it's going to beat out your chest. And I remember I had a random panic attack one day. I was going into work. I was perfectly fine. Had a good day going into work, and it just came on out of nowhere. I could not move. The only thing I could do was call my supervisor, and I couldn't get my words out. And he just came and sat in the car with me just to try to, you know, get me to calm down. But I was frozen. Mm-hmm. I was just frozen in my car from the fear of whatever, something triggered me. So I get it. It's a horrible mm-hmm. feeling, and it's not just the brain. It does affect your body. It at times made me sick and all kinds of other things right. that you did not know could happen until you experienced this yourself.
And something that happened to you in the military that, yeah. that created that. Mm-hmm. You didn't see combat, but you had to deal with something obviously traumatic.
Yeah.
Panic, is it a panic attack, Wyndon?
That can be one expression. So we see panic. We also see something called dissociation. So someone who dissociates, which it sounds like that's what happened in your case, Jacinta, is what we see expressed in behavior as a freeze response. Mm-hmm. But what we know to be true is that in that dissociative process, the nervous system is actually in overdrive. So we are not moving, but the body is in a very intense and complex way. So panic can be one expression, but we might see depression is definitely a huge piece of this. I say at this point that anxiety and depression are best friends or cousins. They come together. And that's also, again, a design in our systems that when you think about it from a curious perspective, it makes a lot of sense. It's a self-enclosed shutoff valve, if you will, that the body really needs in order to survive and sustain this diagnosis.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are marking Veterans Day in this hour of Radio Times, talking with two veterans, also with Wyndon Rowe. She's a therapist who specializes in the treatment of trauma-related diagnoses. Jacinta Johnson is a retired Air Force Staff Sergeant, works now in human resources at the Veterans Multi-Service Center in Philadelphia. And Michael Miller with us as well, a U.S. Marine Corps and Army veteran. He's a poet, owner of Open Mike's Internet Cafe in Chester, Pennsylvania. He's a member of Warrior Writers. He's going to recite a portion of a poem for us as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with our guests Michael Miller, Wyndon Rowe, and Jacinta Johnson as we mark Veterans Day. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, I mentioned the fact that you're a poet. There's a piece of one of your poems I'd love to have you recite for us.
Okay, this is called The Wartime Reality Show, and I'll do a quick snippet. I normally do it with Mr. John Carr, but I understand we don't have a lot of time.
We don't. And he's sitting over here very quietly listening indeed. To all of us.
So it goes, they say that the meek shall inherit the earth. But I'm here today to tell you that the wicked gets it first. Bomb bullets and bad guys, newspapers, newscasters, political lies right now. War is the biggest reality show on TV. But you don't have to take my word for it. I mean, why believe me when you can see it for yourself? So many countries out there needing Americanized help, and our biggest and bravest are literally dying to give it. Just look at all the graveyards out there. Full of patriotic spirits, or ask the children crying out for fallen fathers or mothers, but only you and your living room will ever get the chance to hear it. And the world seems to be such a lonely place for a little boy who has the I miss my daddy blues, his mother's eyes swollen with tears every time he tries on his daddy's boots, but she can't understand that he just wants to feel close to him again. So every day he goes to school and tells teachers, preachers, family, and friends, when I grow up, I want to be just like him. So when he turns 18, off he goes, another contestant for this messed up reality show.
That's beautiful and powerful and very affecting. What was the thinking behind the writing of that poem?
Well, while I was away, my daughters were in high school. They had to wind up going to a different high school, and they wound up joining the ROTC programs and all, and just sitting there looking at my children, and I have all daughters, and they're kind of like following like in my footsteps, and even being in the military so long and seeing so many people go through like different phases, you know, of being in the military and just what it means. And people oftentimes forget that, you know, it, like we were talking about earlier, it does affect like the whole family. You know, children live what they learn. You know, they learn to be like you. They want to emulate you.
Yeah.
You know, they want to be a part of your lives and be just as important, even though they don't see you as much, you know, or they may not necessarily know what you're doing, you know.
Were you a poet before you went to war?
Yes, I wrote a lot.
You've always written?
Yeah, but I didn't write about my military experiences until being in the Army.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Marine Corps was a different kind of atmosphere from the Army. Yeah.
I can imagine. Is it helpful for you to write?
Yeah, it's very, honestly, it's...
To put the words, say the words, not only on the page, but to say them?
Yeah, it's therapeutic. And the reason why I like reciting poetry is because of the simple fact that, you know, it's a situation where nobody responds back. Nobody sits there and says that they understand, because I hate when people tell me they understand. Because they don't understand. If you don't go through what I go through, if you don't know what it's like to, you know, go to bed and then get up a couple of minutes later and check your windows, even though you know you locked it. You know, you don't know how it feels to, you know, worry about things that you really shouldn't have to, you know, worry about. And the saddest part about everything is I oftentimes have to question, you know, what are people really, really doing, you know, for veterans? You know, a lot of people say thank you, and they don't even realize that veterans don't even like it when you say thank you.
I know you told Trine, as she was pre-interviewing you, that you said, don't say that to me.
Yeah.
Because why? Because they don't really understand?
No, it's a mixture of things, and I think it's a little different for everybody. For some people, you know, you don't know what somebody may have done in the line of service, you know, protecting their country, and you're thanking them for that. You don't know how they feel about the things that they may have been through. You don't even know how they feel about, like, it's just like if you worked in an office and your boss said, you know, clean a bathroom, and he could say thank you, but that might be a job that you just hate doing, but it's part of your job, you know? You just never know how somebody's feeling inside.
Well, let me pick up on what Michael was just saying there, and part of the reason for doing the show is what we are describing as this civilian military or veteran divide, the fact that at least today something like 1% or maybe even less percent of the population has anything to do with the military. And in many ways, we live in very different worlds. I was looking at a map, and most of our soldiers and Marines come from a handful of states. They tend to be in the South, for instance, that we don't really know each other. And so when someone says without thinking, thank you to Michael Miller, he doesn't like that. But probably from a civilian perspective, they think they're doing something nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a challenging answer for me to come up with, because I kind of have like a foot in both worlds.
Right.
I'm not of the military, but I was raised in it. And I had a life experience where my dad was gone most of my life, and he was a weekend warrior, if that. I remember hearing his car pull into the driveway. I mean, I can still hear it, and being so elated to see him and know that we were going to have our father-daughter Friday afternoon ritual. And then that feeling of, you know, like my tummy dropping out and hearing him pull out of the driveway on Sunday, and the challenges that we faced in our home with him being gone so much. And at the same time, I consider myself a civilian, you know, right. I have that influence, but I did not go to boot camp. I did not serve. And so I kind of see it from both sides, and I understand, you know, and what I hear from a lot of the men and women that I work with is, and it's so interesting, there's so much humility in the military, but you don't expect it because of this sort of cultural vision of what we have of this, you know, tough guy, tough girl, soldier. But there really is such an intense softness and a quiet that exists in such a bold culture. And I think that we as American citizens want to say thank you. You know, my dad says his duty and the oath that he swore to is to protect the Constitution of the United States of America. And so when you're an American citizen, you want to say thank you. I have freedoms. I can vote. I have the freedom of speech. And so I think that we want to express gratitude, but I think that we need to kind of redirect how we do that.
Well, and it does get you thinking about some of the myths, the stereotypes. As you were saying, Michael, this notion of PTSD, first of all, not everyone who serves has PTSD, and it's not like people come home and go crazy.
Yeah.
It's just you're, you know, there's a kind of suffering inside. Do you want to add anything to our conversation, Jacinta?
It's just interesting to listen to your perspective about how it impacted you as a child when your dad was leaving. And it kind of ties into what you were saying during your poem.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't think about how it impacts the family as a whole. I watched my daughter change.
And we should say your husband is in the Air Force as well.
My husband is a staff sergeant in the Air Force out at McGuire Air Force Base. And he's gone a lot.
Right.
And the first time my daughter experienced her dad leaving, she was too young to really say what she felt, so she acted out. She acted out in ways that I had never seen, and I was just like, man, who's this little girl that I'm dealing with? You know, this wasn't my happy child. This was my now frustrated child because she couldn't say, Mom, I miss Dad, you know? So people, I don't think, always understand how it affects everyone in the family. You know, for me, it was okay because I was serving at the time. I've had to leave. There's been plenty of times where, you know, I had to say goodbye to my husband. I'll see you later. But that was prior to me having my little girl.
Sure.
So that was hard for her.
Yeah.
She can't, and she couldn't talk at that time either. So it was even harder.
Yeah. I think most people don't even realize how you have to compartmentalize the things in your life when you leave like that. It's nothing like, you know, seeing your baby with no teeth and coming back, and now the baby has, you know, a whole top drawer. You're like, well, what's going on here?
I'm not walking.
You
and
miss
now
a
walking.
Lot of the milestones. And it's so crazy because children are so resilient.
Mm-hmm.
They just really are. Their love doesn't change because you're not there. And that makes it can make a person feel like a failure in a way, like I don't deserve all of this love that you give me because
as a parent,
I'm not here.
It.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Because you know what? We're human just like everybody else. You know what I mean? The things hurt us. We think about stuff. But the sad part about everything is you don't have time in a war zone to be, you know, worried about your family or crying about things. You know, if you're married and you have a good girl, if you have a girlfriend or whatever the case may be, you count on the people in the rear to like, not bring those little problems up to you because I have to focus on this. I have to focus on getting back home. That is my job. I have to take care of the people that are sitting next to me, the people that are in front of me, regardless to what the mission is. I have to make it back. They have to make it back. We have to make it back together, you know?
There's so much I want to pick up on. One thing that you said, Wyndon, just about perhaps some of the myths and stereotypes about the military, but I was also reading that it is one, at least according to Gallup, perhaps the most trusted institution that we have in this country. People, we know how people feel about Congress. We know how they feel about the media. I mean, and there are other institutions that are also under a cloud, but it's, I think it was like 75% of the country has a very positive feeling about the military. Now, whether that's knee-jerk or whether that's heartfelt, I don't know. But it's an interesting way that the military seems to stand out as an institution.
So if we separate the politics from military involvement in the world and we just look at it as an organization and its structure, everything is the same. So you, no matter what your race, creed, gender, age, are expected to fulfill your duty as required. And in the civilian world, that does not exist at all. And it's incredibly frustrating for those of us that are so accustomed to that structure, to operate in a structureless society where, you know, Dave to my right.
I have to say, both of our the other guests are nodding their head. No, go ahead, Wyndon.
So Dave to my right can show up to a meeting 15 minutes late, and, you know, Diane to my left can be there on time, and one will deliver, one will not. But there really isn't any kind of repercussion for that. In the military, that does not happen. And that actually sets the stage and the tone for there is so much diversity inside of this organization, but the expectation is the same. Mm-hmm. And so the camaraderie is really there. It's so team oriented. And here in this country, there's definitely a separation from that.
Yeah. And that's such a powerful thing. I mean, just since I'm thinking about just the power of relationships, the power of community, the power of someone who's got your back. I mean, that's something it's almost built into the military.
It is. It's very built into it. And you hold on to those relationships sometimes for dear life because you know that this man, this woman is going to have my back regardless, even on the field when you're fighting and when you're home, you know, and at the during the regular day-to-day mission. Mm-hmm. I still to this day have some of my best friends are in the military. You know, to this day, I still speak to my last supervisor from my last duty station. He actually texted me yesterday. Hey, how you been? I haven't heard from you. Hey, I'm good. You know, so you do. You, it's just such a family.
Sure. A family.
It's a family. I mean,
that's a powerful word. You want to add anything,
yeah,
Michael?
It gets the crazy part about everything is a lot of people do. I think America does embrace the military as a whole because we're kind of ingrained in society because we're family members, we're brothers, we're sisters. You know, we outnumber Congress and things of that nature. You know, you see us everywhere doing something. And normally, if we are your friends, we are your best friend. You tell us a secret, that's going to the grave. Mm-hmm. You know, you call me at 3:30 in the morning because your tire blew out and you 20 miles away, I'm coming. You know, I will never leave you behind. The sad part is once you get out of the military, in a sense, you are kind of left behind. You know, a lot of people don't understand that. As a vet, for instance, there is legislation that's supposed to be in place where if you hire a vet, you get perks and things of that nature. I had a friend on Facebook that I served with. I was in Afghanistan, but I had to send him a message because he had posted something on Facebook just saying, hey, do anybody know where there's any homeless veteran shelters? And if you follow down his timeline, you'll see he said, you know, I applied for this many jobs and I haven't gotten one, you know, and I guess most people feel good with the dog and pony show. And it's a lot of stuff that could be said, but there's two types of truths. There's the truth and then there's the truth. Nobody wants the truth. You know, they just want the truth. They want what makes them feel good.
The easy truth.
Yeah,
yes.
they want what makes society feels like it's working.
Flowers.
But it's broken so badly when you can go and sacrifice everything. Like, they don't realize you sacrifice your family, you know, for a higher calling.
Mm-hmm.
You do. Your health, your mental well-being. We sacrifice everything. And then when you come back and you want to do something, nobody really has answers for you.
Nope.
But was it worth it for you, Michael?
For me, every single moment of it was. And if I had to do it all again, and I always tell people I would do it all again. And I had people say, well, even if you got blown up again, would you do it again? And I'm like, yeah, because you know what? When I was out there, there was plenty of my friends who felt down or something bad was going on back home. And I may have been, you know, that hand that reached back to hold them up.
Exactly.
Or I might have been the shoulders that they stood on to get through that rough period of time as people were for me. And if I wasn't in place, what's to say that would have happened?
How about for you, Jacinda?
Yeah, without a second thought. You know, for me, I always thought that my career would be 20 or more. So for it to be cut short, it was heartbreaking because, like I said, that's my family.
Well, I'm thinking, too, Wyndon, and we've been a little bit about that reentry process, whether you served or whether you didn't serve, the reentry, I guess, out of the military, mm-hmm. whether it's a base in this country or a base in another country, mm-hmm. what that is like, and whether there are things like loneliness and, or just feeling that sense of being alone, you don't have that same community.
This is unofficial, but I call it like the lone wolf syndrome, I think, is a really good metaphor that you are designed over time to be a pack animal, and then you come home and you're the only person of your kind everywhere you go. And this has a huge implication. I know University of Delaware recently reported that 50% of their incoming veteran students drop out within, and I might misquote this, but I think it's within the first year. And that's an extremely high dropout rate. So we need to look at that. These are not people that are not qualified to be students. These are people who have needs that are not being met on a community level. And so what I find really interesting about the work that I'm doing right now is that I see some vets clinically, meaning they come in for individual sessions and I help to counsel them. But a lot of the work that I'm starting to do is more almost like on a consulting level where I help assist in the design and implementation of grassroots community-oriented programs that get all of these people in a room together, whether it's just the veteran or the veteran and their spouse or the veteran and their families, and to create some kind of platform where there's unity there because that is clearly missing upon reentry.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Wyndon Rowe. She's a therapist. She specializes in the treatment of trauma-related diagnoses. Her dad, an Air Force colonel, Jacinta Johnson with us as well, recently retired Air Force Staff Sergeant and now works in human resources at the Veterans Multi-Service Center in Philadelphia, and Michael Miller. He's a veteran of the Army and the U.S. Marine Corps. He's a poet. He shared part of one of his poems, owner of Open Mike's Internet Cafe in Chester, Pennsylvania. I do want to talk about that, and a member of Warrior Writers. And we want to get some people into our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking about dispelling some of the myths about what it means to serve, to be in the military, with our three guests. And, of course, as we are marking Veterans Day, let me get Jeff from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. And, Jeff, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Marty. Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I'm a college professor, one of those left-wing socialist commie types. And I have to say that the teacher has become the student. And one thing I related all the things you're talking about with the PTSD is this. I think people who don't serve do not understand that, you know, war is not a movie. I have had so many students. I had one student in particular teach me that he was in a particular situation. He and his guys had a child approaching them with like C4 or some sort of explosive unstrapped to him. He had a choice. Either he is going to shoot that kid, or he's going to let the kid come to him, and they were all going to die. Either way, he loses. Mm-hmm. There is no rational, moral decision. You cannot judge. You know, and he shot him, and he said he lives with it. He lives with it.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I'm almost breaking down.
Yeah, well, you know what, Jeff? Let me take your comment, because I'm looking at Michael, and I know Wyndham wants to say something as well. Michael, what do you say back to Jeff or say to our listeners?
Well, I think it ties into when we were talking about people saying, like, thank you. Like, do you think, like, somebody wants to be thanked because they had to make a choice? And I don't care what anybody says. Even with the election, you hear the lesser of two evils. Let me tell you something. The lesser of two evils is still evil. Regardless. And when you do something and you have to live with the decisions you made, you saved a life and the life was lost. I mean, how do you rationalize that out to yourself to make yourself feel better? Because you have to wake up with you. You have to go to bed with you. You have to live with every decision that you make, even if it's a forced decision.
Wyndon, I know you want to add something.
I think, you know, my field is so limited. I think that we create, and I know we're well-intended. I'm not trying to bash on the clinical world, but we create these diagnoses and we become so prescriptive in how we look at people, and we try and compartmentalize and box, and we want to check things off. And, you know, one of my limitations is that, you know, this is so far beyond PTSD. I might work with someone who has no symptomatic expression, but they're living with what we call moral injury, which is the injurious effect of having to make those split-second decisions that you cannot reverse for the rest of your life. You might not have flashbacks. You might not be waking up in the middle of the night checking your locks, but you have that shame and that guilt and that difficult, you know, moment to constantly find some kind of peace with, and that's far beyond the diagnostic aspect of this.
Jacinta, I'm interested in the work that you do at the Veterans Multi-Service Center, the kind of people that come in and what you have learned there.
Well, we see a little bit of everything, to be honest. You see homeless. Our mission there is ending homelessness, which, you know, we are proud to say that we felt like we have. So now we offer...
In Philadelphia, right?
In Philadelphia, yes. So we offer services such as employee training, getting them the resources they need to get back on their feet. So whether that means, you know, getting them into a housing program or just something, we offer all those services. And we also offer a chance. We have two VSOs on staff. So those are our veteran service officers. So if you need to come do your claim, you can also do that as well. And we're looking at getting another one. So we offer a lot of services that are there, and use them, folks, you know. Get to the VMC, the Veteran Multi-Service Center, and let us help you. So.
Is it hard, do you think, for people to ask for help?
It is. I think it's hard to ask for help because it's putting your pride aside. You know, we've been used to this culture.
It's a culture.
Yeah. We've been used to this culture for so long. And when you get out, that culture's not there anymore. So now where do you go? And a lot of us don't know where to go. And the Veteran Multi-Service Center can be that place to go.
Let me get another caller on. I know I have a couple of questions for you, Michael. This is Dan from Philadelphia. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. And...
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm a veteran, but I have never served in war. So I served in the Army National Guard during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I never actually went overseas. And I've always felt a bit of maybe some sense of shame, or that I really didn't do my service, or that I'm somehow maybe not a vet or as much of a vet. But I wanted to get your caller's perspectives on that. Maybe are these kinds of feelings valid? And what are their perspectives on veterans who have served but not necessarily served in war?
Yeah. You served.
Yeah. I'm looking at you, Jacinta, because you served not in war, but you served. Go ahead.
I served. I did deploy. I didn't go to a hostile environment like what Mike went to. So you served. You signed your name on that dotted line. You got taken away from your normal environment that you were used to. So you served, and be proud of that. Today is for you.
Yeah,
well,
Michael?
There's people who may, even though you go into like a war zone, you could be on a fob being a cook. You could be working in an office or whatever the case may be. And believe it or not, sometimes those people have the same exact feelings that you have, the same exact feelings that you have. But let me tell you something. If you in the rear, you're helping to train up other soldiers that are coming into theater. You're being a leader back here. So it's just like you raising a child, if you will.
Yes.
You know, if they go off into the NBA, do you not feel a part of that? Uh-huh. If they be a doctor or a lawyer and do important things, are you not a part of that? You're a part of the process, which makes you important to that. So you do serve, and for you, I'd say thank you for your service.
Wyndon, you want to add something?
I mean, I think that hits the nail on the head. I don't think that, you know, you have to be in theater to have a valid experience in the military. It is a community effort, and everybody's, you know, part plays an important role.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Let me ask you about Open Mike's Internet Cafe. This is something you started in Chester. How long has that been around?
I'm in my third year, and it's really interesting because I'm kind of fighting with the process of like gentrification going on and everything. But that's another conversation.
Yeah.
It's been a rough road, but I've really opened up my cafe for my community and for people to come down and be able to express themselves, you know, in a way that they may not have been able to. You know, it's working out pretty good. It's a bit of a beacon. I'm going through growing pains as you do in anything. But I opened it up. Another reason I opened it up was just simply because I knew coming back here, man, I couldn't work for nobody.
Really? You just knew that wasn't going to happen?
Yeah, I got too much going on here, you know, especially when depression hits and it's something that you just can't pull yourself out of. You know, it's like being present but not being there. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't make yourself do stuff sometimes. And I have to make my world and live in it. Because if I live in everybody else's world, it's not really going to work out for me, you know. And even with us talking about PTSD being diagnosed and things of that nature, it's so funny. I think people treat the parameters of it, you know, but they don't treat the person. They treat what they know it to be and not the specific person, because there's a lot of those categories that I may not fall into, you know. Okay, no, this doesn't happen for me, but this does happen for me, you know, and we get so caught up in the diagnosis of it all and instead of the actual person.
Sure. I mean, is it sort of a mission? I mean, in a way, open your cafe a kind of a mission?
Definitely.
I think it looks like Deb from Jenkintown to join our conversation. Hi, Deb. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
So I was listening to what the veterans on your show were saying about how they feel about non-military people saying thank you to them. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a way that we can show you our understanding of the important role that you play in protecting our society and our country without saying thank you.
Do you want to take that, Jacinda?
I personally don't mind you saying thank you. But I can see Mike's perspective because he's been through different things that I have been through. But support us. Support us. Understand that we have days where we're just like, I want to cry. I don't want to be around. I don't want to exist. We have those days. Support us and be there and be our voice. We need a voice.
A big thing for me personally, and one thing that I've really been pushing a lot to people that I speak with is, you know, supporting in a way such as, you know, on a large scale, you know, trying to affect like legislation and stuff that's not just a bunch of fluff and something that's actually going to help, like dissemination of information, even if it was programs like set up where, you know, you actually have like social workers or something that shadow you that help you out. You know, when I wanted to open my business, honestly, I used the money from me getting hurt to open my business. And that should have been used for like my family and things of that nature. But I took a chance to do it on a smaller scale. What I would say is if you know vet-owned businesses, support vet-owned businesses like you support Walmart, because we create jobs. And as vets, we're going to give vets jobs,
yes.
You know, because we understand what it means to be a vet. We understand because we've been there. You know?
What do you think, Wendy? Yeah, go ahead.
We have 20 veterans a day right now that are committing suicide. That is not all trauma-related suicide. So that is not everybody that is committing suicide has served in theater. Mm-hmm. But there's a fallout for that, and that has a rippling effect through communities. For example, there's an organization that I've been supporting that WHYY has featured called The Weekly Fight. That's a CrossFit organization where they bring veterans and their families in, and they do a weekly workout that looks a lot like what you would do in training. And so you get that camaraderie. You have something that's health-oriented where there's an opportunity to connect, and they need help. Their mission is to support these families that are dealing with the fallout from these suicides. One of my favorite quotes that I keep reposting on my Facebook page is, the Dalai Lama says that the problem with this country is that we value things more than people. And so how can you get involved and support people and not necessarily throw money at it, but how can you throw your energy and your true support through action?
Let me read a comment from Nell. I love this poignant discussion with the vets. So appreciate their candid and touching remarks. Wondering how they will deal with depression, et cetera, on a daily basis. They sound so well adjusted now. Do they use medication or similar techniques? Which picks up on something we were talking earlier, which is that you can have some kind of stress disorder or even PTSD and live a life. Right, Wendy? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, we know that in my field, I can't speak to this 100% because I'm not necessarily trained in this, but I do teach classes and organizations to get clinicians up to date on the new research. And that is, there are applications through pharmacology that are effective, but that's short term. And like if we go back to an earlier part of the discussion where we look at this as a body response, if we're not treating the body and we're not looking at things like sleep hygiene, nutrition, meeting emotional needs, looking at how are we treating ourselves physically, how are we exercising, we're not looking at the whole health of the person, we can't beat this. It can't come from just a pill. It's not working.
Mm. Yeah, well, even with pills Michael. Come side effects and things of that nature. Like I've been on medication and everything, and you know, it everything is a guess. They give you this, it zonks you out. They give you, you know, that, and it increases your dreams or it stops your dreams, but you know, all of a sudden, you know, you experience another problem. You know, the sad part about everything is it is really important to get to understand the individual and the method you could take, because everything does not work for everybody. It's not a one size fits all pill out there in the world. It's just not. But that's why I do appreciate the fact that I can write down things and I can relay those things to other people, because it's therapy for me and it's therapeutic for other people. And that's why I'm thankful for the Warrior Writers. I'm thankful for the ability to be able to express myself the way that I do.
Jacinda, we want to add to that. I'm looking at you there.
I do. We have to stop shoving pills down our throats as the only method. I got to a point where I literally told my doctor, I'm not changing my medicine anymore. Stop it. That's not just working. I need something else. And I got something else. And I was really happy that I was able to go get therapy. And it was group therapy. And they taught me how to meditate. They taught me how to respond to my body. They taught me how to quiet down my body, my thoughts, and really reconnect, because I had lost myself. I became PTSD.
Wow. Wendy. Almost out of time.
And this is not, again, a negative comment against psychiatry, because I know it's well-intended. But if I go into my PCP, my primary care provider, and I say, I'm having chest pains, that person needs to assess my heart, my lungs, my ribs, all aspects of that part of my body, and then come up with a diagnosis and then treat. In psychiatry, this is a lot of guesswork, and it's based on behavior, and we do not evaluate the actual structure right now, and that is a disservice to anybody who is seeking mental health treatment.
Well, I do wish we could go on. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Appreciate your honesty. Thank you for the poem, Michael.
Not a problem.
And thank you, Jacinda, for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jacinda Johnson, recently retired Air Force Staff Sergeant, works now in Human Resources at the Veterans Multi-Service Center in Philadelphia. Michael Miller is a veteran of the Army and the U.S. Marine Corps, owner of Open Mike's Internet Cafe in Chester, Pennsylvania, member of the Warrior Writers, and Wyndon Rowe, a therapist who specializes in the treatment of diagnoses of trauma-related diagnoses. We're going to close things out. Leonard Cohen's song, Everybody Knows. He died yesterday, age of 82.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
And again. again, that was Leonard Cohen. Everybody knows from his 1988 album, I'm Your Man, co-written with Sharon Robinson, and he died yesterday at the age of 82. Coming up next is Radio Times in Review, understanding the mindset of white working class people who played a key role in electing Donald Trump and a critique of the Democratic Party. That's coming up next here on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.